and governments, but that has passed away. But at no time had his problems been simple. Apart from the interlude of the Peel Ministry of 1841 to 46, an interlude which had ended in party disaster, the Tories had been more or less in opposition for close on half a century. Labelled the Party of Reaction, its members mocked as the heirs of Eldon, Sidmouth and other hard-shelled old Tories, it now had to face a democratic electorate. The fact that the extension of the franchise had been sponsored by the Tory leader made it no less a leap in the dark for them. But Disraeli had no doubts. He remained true to the spirit of the Young England movement, which he'd founded a generation before, and he never believed that the working men of England were radicals or would-be destroyers of the established order. He saw clearly that although many of the new electors were attracted by the ideas of tradition, continuity, and ordered social progress, such feelings would never ripen into electoral advantage under the inert conservatism of his own backbenchers. He had not only to win over the electorate, but also to convert his own party. Disraeli's campaign began long before Gladstone fell. He concentrated on social reform and on a new conception of the empire, and both prongs of attack struck Gladstone at his weakest points. The empire had never aroused his interest, and though passionate in defence of the political rights of the working class, he cared little for their material claims. Disraeli, on the other hand, proclaimed that the first consideration of a minister should be the health of the people. Liberals tried to laugh this off as a policy of sewage. In his first full session after reaching office, Disraeli proceeded to redeem his pledge. He was fortunate in his colleagues, among whom the Home Secretary, Richard Cross, was outstanding in ability. A Trade Union Act gave the unions almost complete freedom of action. An Artisans' Dwelling Act was the first measure to tackle the housing problem. A Sale of Food and Drugs Act and a Public Health Act at last established sanitary law on a sound footing. Disraeli succeeded in persuading much of the Conservative Party not only that the real needs of the electorate included healthier conditions of life, better homes, and freedom to organise in the world of industry, but also that the Conservative Party was perfectly well fitted to provide them. Well might Alexander Macdonald, the miners' leader, declare that the Conservative Party have done more for the working classes in 5 years than the Liberals have in 50. Gladstone had provided the administrative basis for these great developments, but Disraeli took the first considerable steps in promoting social welfare. The second part of the new Conservative programme, imperialism, had also been launched before Disraeli came to power. Gladstone's passion for economy in all things military, his caution in Europe, and his indifference to the empire jarred on a public which was growing ever more conscious of British imperial glory. Disraeli's appeal was perfectly tuned to the new mood. "Self-government, in my opinion," he said of the colonies, "when it was conceded, ought to have been conceded as part of a great policy of imperial consolidation. It ought to have been accompanied by an imperial tariff, by securities for the people of England for the enjoyment of the unappropriated lands which belonged to the sovereign as their trustee, and by a military code which should have precisely defined the means and the responsibilities by which the colonies should be defended, and by which, if necessary, this country should call for aid from the colonies themselves. It ought further to have been accompanied by the institution of some representative council in the metropolis, which would have brought the colonies into constant and continuous relations with the home government. All this, however, was omitted because those who advised that policy, and I believe their convictions were sincere, looked upon the colonies of England, looked upon even our connection with India, as a burden upon this country, viewing everything in its financial aspect and totally passing by those moral and political considerations which make nations great, and by the influence of which men alone are distinguished from the animals. Well, what has been the result of this attempt during the reign of liberalism for the disintegration of the empire? It has entirely failed. But how has it failed? through the sympathy of the colonies for the mother country. They have decided that the empire shall not be destroyed, and in my opinion, no minister in this country will do his duty who neglects any opportunity of reconstructing as much as possible our colonial empire, and of responding to those distant sympathies which may become the source of incalculable strength and happiness to this land. At first, Disraeli was brilliantly successful. The Suez Canal had been open for 6 years and had transformed the strategic position of Great Britain. No longer was the Cape of Good Hope the key to the route to India and the Far East. The Foreign Office had been curiously slow to appreciate this obvious fact and had missed more than one opportunity to control the waterway. In 1875, Disraeli, on behalf of the British government, bought for £4 million the shares of the Egyptian Khedive, Ismail, in the canal. This Turkish satrap was bankrupt and glad to sell. His holding amounted to nearly half the total issue. The route to India was safeguarded. A possible threat to British naval supremacy was removed, and, of fateful importance for the future, Britain was inexorably drawn into Egyptian politics. In the following year, Queen Victoria, to her great pleasure, was proclaimed Empress of India. Such a stroke would never have occurred to Gladstone, or indeed to the next generation of imperialists. But Disraeli's oriental, almost mystical approach to empire, his emphasis on imperial symbols, his belief in the importance of outward display, gave his policy an imaginative colour never achieved by his successors. His purpose was to make those colonies which he had once condemned as millstones round our necks sparkle like diamonds. New storms in Europe distracted attention from this glittering prospect. In 1876, the Eastern Question erupted anew. The Crimean War had been mismanaged by the soldiers, and at the peace, the diplomats had done no better. Most of the Balkans still remained under Turkish rule, and all attempts to improve the Ottoman administration of Christian provinces had foundered on the obstinacy of the Sultan and the magnitude of the task. Slavs, Romanians, and Greeks were united in their detestation of the Turk. Revolt offered little hope of permanent success, and they'd long looked to the Tsar of Russia as their potential liberator. Here was a fine dilemma for the British government. The possibility of creating independent Balkan states, in spite of Canning's example in the small Greek kingdom, was not yet seriously contemplated. The nice choice appeared to lie between bolstering Turkish power and allowing Russian influence to move through the Balkans and into the Mediterranean by way of Constantinople. The threat had long been present, and the insurrection which now occurred confronted Disraeli with the most difficult and dangerous situation for Great Britain since the Napoleonic Wars. Rebellion broke out in Bosnia and Herzegovina, where 40 years later, an assassin's bullet was to start the First World War. Germany, Austria, and Russia, united in the League of Three Emperors, proposed that Turkey should be coerced into making serious reforms. Disraeli and his Foreign Secretary, Lord Derby, resisted these plans, arguing that they must end very soon in the disintegration of Turkey. And to emphasize British support of Turkey, a fleet was dispatched to the Dardanelles. But these diplomatic manoeuvres were soon overtaken by the news of terrible Turkish atrocities in Bulgaria. Disraeli, handicapped by faulty reports from his ambassador at Constantinople, who was an admirer of the Turks, failed to measure the deep stir in public opinion. In reply to a parliamentary question in July, he took leave to doubt whether torture has been practiced on a great scale among an Oriental people who seldom, I believe, resort to torture, but generally terminate their connection with culprits in a more expeditious manner. This tone of persiflage fanned into fierce and furious activity the profound moral feeling which was always simmering just below the surface of Gladstone's mind. In a famous pamphlet, The Bulgarian Horrors and the Question of the East, Gladstone delivered his onslaught on the Turks and Disraeli's government. "Let the Turks now carry away their abuses in the only possible manner," namely, by carrying off themselves. Their Zaptiers and their Mudirs, their Bimbashis and their Yuzbashis, their Kaimakams and their Pashas, one and all bag and baggage, shall, I hope, clear out from the provinces they have desolated and profaned. This thorough riddance, this most blessed deliverance, is the only reparation we can make to the memory of those heaps on heaps of dead, to the violated purity alike of matron, of maiden, and of child. There is not a criminal in a European jail, there is not a cannibal in the South Sea Islands, whose indignation would not arise and overboil at the recital of that which has been done, which has too late been examined, but which remains unavenged, which has left behind all the foul and all the fierce passions that produced it, and which may again spring up in another more murderous harvest, from the soil soaked and reeking with blood, and in the air tainted with every imaginable deed of crime and shame. No government ever has so sinned. None has proved itself so incorrigible in sin, or, which is the same, so impotent for reformation. After this broadside, relations between the two great men became so strained that Lord Beaconsfield, as Disraeli now was, publicly described Gladstone as worse than any Bulgarian horror. At the end of the year, a conference of the great powers was held in Constantinople, at which Lord Salisbury, as the British representative, displayed for the first time his diplomatic talents. Salisbury was the direct descendant of Queen Elizabeth's great servant, William Cecil, and of James I's minister, Robert Cecil, whose namesake he was. Over a period of 20 years in both Houses of Parliament, he'd been highly critical of his chief. He joined Disraeli's government only after much heart-searching. But in office, gradually the two men grew together. Salisbury's caustic, far-ranging common sense supplemented Disraeli's darting vision. As Secretary of State for India, and later at the Foreign Office, Salisbury established himself as the next predestined Tory leader. At Constantinople, a programme of reform for Turkey was drawn up. But the Turks, sustained in part by a belief that Salisbury's zeal for reform did not entirely reflect the views of his Prime Minister and the British Cabinet, rejected it. The delegates returned to their capitals, and Europe waited for war to break out between Russia and Turkey. When it came, in the summer of 1877, the mood of the country quickly changed. Gladstone, whose onslaught on the Turks had at first carried all before it, was now castigated as a pro-Russian. Feeling rose as, month after month, in spite of heroic Turkish resistance, especially at Plevna in Bulgaria, the mass of Russian troops moved ponderously towards the Dardanelles. At last, in January 1878, they stood before the walls of Constantinople. Public opinion reached fever point. The music hall song of the hour was, "We don't want to fight, but by jingo if we do, we've got the ships, we've got the men, we've got the money, too. We fought the bear before, and while we're Britons true, the Russians shall not have Constantinople." In February, after considerable prevarication, a fleet of British ironclads steamed into the Golden Horn. They lay in the Sea of Marmara, opposite the Russian army, for 6 uneasy months of truce. The whale, as Bismarck said, facing the elephant. In March, Turkey and Russia signed the Treaty of San Stefano. Andrassy, the Austrian foreign minister, in anger called it an orthodox Slavic sermon. It gave Russia effective control of the Balkans, and was obviously unacceptable to the other great powers. War again seemed likely, and Lord Derby, who objected to any kind of military preparations, resigned. He was replaced at the Foreign Office by Lord Salisbury, who immediately set about summoning a conference of the great powers. They met at the Congress of Berlin in June and July. Business was dominated by Andrassy, Beaconsfield, Bismarck, and the Russian minister Gorchakov, a quartet whose combined diplomatic talents would have been difficult to match. The result was that Russia gave up much of what she had momentarily gained at San Stefano. She kept Romanian Bessarabia, which extended her territories to the mouths of the Danube, But the big Bulgaria, which she had planned to dominate, was split into three parts, only one of which was granted practical independence. The rest was returned to the Sultan. Austria-Hungary, as we must now call the Habsburg Empire, secured in compensation the right to occupy and administer Bosnia-Herzegovina. By a separate Anglo-Turkish convention, Great Britain received Cyprus and guaranteed the territorial integrity of Turkey in Asia in return for yet another pledge by the Sultan to introduce proper reforms. Beaconsfield returned from Berlin claiming that he'd brought peace with honour. He had indeed averted war, and for the moment Russia, blocked in the Balkans, turned her gaze away from Europe to the Far East. The arrangements at Berlin have been much criticised for laying the trail to the War of 1914, but the Eastern question, as it was then posed before the nations, was virtually insoluble. No settlement could have been more than a temporary one, and the Congress of Berlin in fact ensured the peace of Europe for 36 years. The following weeks saw the zenith of Beaconsfield's career, but fortune soon ceased to smile upon him. Thrusting policies in South Africa and Afghanistan led, in 1879, to the destruction of a British battalion by the Zulus at Isandlwana, and the massacre of the legation staff at Kabul. These minor disasters, though promptly avenged, lent fresh point to Gladstone's vehement assault upon the government, an assault which reached its climax in the autumn of 1879 with the Midlothian campaign. Gladstone denounced a vigorous, that is to say, a narrow, restless, blustering and self-assertive foreign policy, appealing to the self-love and pride of the community. He argued that Britain should pursue the path of morality and justice, free from the taint of self-interest. Her aims should be self-government for subject peoples and the promotion of a true concert of Europe. His constant theme was the need for the nation's policy to conform with the moral law. "Remember," he said at Dalkeith, "that the sanctity of life in the hill villages of Afghanistan among the winter snows is as inviolable in the eyes of Almighty God as can be your own." This appeal to morality infuriated the Conservatives, who based their case on the importance of defending and forwarding British interests and responsibilities wherever they might lie. They maintained that Beaconsfield's policy had raised national power and prestige to new heights. But the force of Gladstone's oratory was too much for the exhausted ministry. Moreover, their last years in office coincided with the onset of an economic depression, serious enough for industry, but ruinous for agriculture. When Beaconsfield dissolved in March 1880, the electoral result was decisive. The Queen was forced to accept as Prime Minister for a second time the man whom she described in a letter to her private secretary, Sir Henry Ponsonby, as that half-mad firebrand who would soon ruin everything. While the duel between Disraeli and Gladstone held the centre of the stage, far-reaching movements were taking shape below the surface of parliamentary politics. The Reform Act of 1867, in granting the vote to virtually every adult male resident in a borough, killed the modified 18th-century regime which had persisted since 1832. The emergence of a mass electorate called for a new kind of politics. Sheer numbers rendered the old techniques ineffective in the large cities. Two things were required: a party policy which would persuade the electors to vote, and an efficient organisation to make sure that they did so. Of the two leaders, Gladstone was slow to see the implications of the new age. The great demagogue was bored by the ordinary, everyday business of party. Disraeli, on the other hand, produced both a policy and an organisation. 12 years earlier, he'd appointed John Gorst as party manager, under whose guidance the Conservative Party was completely overhauled. The central office was established, and a network of local associations was set up, combined in a national union. The transition was remarkably smooth, and although there were to be storms in the early 1880s, the system created by Disraeli still largely remains at the present time. In the Liberal camp, the situation was very different. Gladstone's coolness and Whig hostility prevented the building of a centralised party organisation. The impulse and impetus came not from the centre, but through the provinces. In 1873, Joseph Chamberlain had become mayor of Birmingham. Aided by a most able political adviser, Schnadhorst, he built up a party machine which, although based on popular participation, his enemies quickly condemned as a caucus. A policy of municipal socialism brought great benefits to Birmingham in the shape of public utilities, slum clearance, and other civic amenities. The movement spread to other towns and cities, and a national liberal federation was born. The aim of its promoters was to make the federation the parliament of the liberal movement, which would work out a radical program and eventually replace the Whigs by a new set of leaders drawn from its own ranks. This was a novel phenomenon. Unlike Chartism and the Anti-Corn Law League, movements for reform need no longer operate on the fringe of party. Radicalism was now powerful enough to make a bid for control. This change was greatly aided by the clustering of the parties round opposite social poles, a process well underway by 1880, and which Gladstone recognised in the course of his election campaign. "I am sorry," he declared, "to say we cannot reckon upon the aristocracy. We cannot reckon upon what is called the landed interest. We cannot reckon upon the clergy of the established church, either in England or in Scotland. We cannot reckon upon the wealth of the country, nor upon the rank of the country. In the main, these powers are against us. We must set them down among our most determined foes." At the election, Chamberlain and his followers put forward a programme of reform which was unacceptable to the Whigs, and indeed to Gladstone. Their success exposed and proclaimed the wide changes which the new franchise had wrought in the structure of the party system. Gladstone and Disraeli had done much to bridge the gap between aristocratic rule and democracy. They both believed that governments should be active, and the statute books for the years between 1868 and 1876 bulged with reforming measures. Elections gradually became a judgment on what the government of the day had accomplished, and an assessment of the promises for the future made by the two parties. By 1880, they were being fought with techniques which differ very little from those used today. Gladstone's Midlothian campaign, the first broad appeal to the people by a potential prime minister, underlined the change. It shocked the Queen that he should make a speech about foreign policy from a railway carriage window, but her protest echoed an age that had already passed. This was the way to become the People's William. Beaconsfield died a year later. His great task, taken on almost single-handed, had been to lead the Conservative Party out of the despair of the period after 1846, to persuade it to face the inevitability of democracy, and to endow it with the policies which would meet the new conditions. That he was successful is a remarkable indication of his skill in all matters related to party. He made the Conservatives a great force in democratic politics. The large-scale two-party system with its swing of the pendulum begins with him. Tory democracy, working men by hundreds of thousands who voted Conservative, became the dominant factor. The extension of the franchise, which had hitherto threatened to engulf the past, bore it proudly forward. Whereas the Whigs vanished from the scene, the Tories, though they were slow to realise it, sprang into renewed life and power with a fair future before them. Such was the work of Disraeli, for which his name will be duly honoured. Chapter 3. American Reconstruction. Across the Atlantic, the victory of Northern arms had preserved American unity, but immense problems had now to be faced. The most urgent was that of restoring order and prosperity to the defeated Confederacy. Great areas in the South, along the line of Sherman's March and in the Valley of Virginia, had been devastated. Atlanta, Columbia, Charleston, Richmond, and other cities had been grievously damaged by bombardment and fire. The life of the South had come to a standstill. Farming, denied a market by the Northern blockade, had fallen into stagnation, despite the heroic efforts of Southern women and the faithful slaves to keep the land in cultivation. The blockade had also caused severe shortages in many common goods, and the breakdown of transport within the Confederacy had brought all within the grip of famine. The entire and inflated southern banking system had collapsed. Confederate paper money and securities were now worthless. The whole region was reduced to penury. As the ragged, hungry soldiers of the Confederacy made their way homeward after Appomattox, they were everywhere confronted by scenes of desolation and ruin. Reconstruction was the word. But a prime difficulty in reconstructing the South was the future of the Negro. In spite of Lincoln's proclamation of 1863, which nominally freed the slaves in the rebellious states, millions of them had continued throughout the war to work loyally for their old owners. At the end of the war, many of them believed that emancipation meant that they need no longer work. They made off to the nearest town or army camp, depriving the plantations of their labor, and presenting the Union authorities with an alarming problem. There was another reason for tackling the question of the Negro, for in some parts of the Union he was legally still a slave. Lincoln's proclamation had abolished slavery only in those areas under Confederate control. It had not applied either to the parts of the Confederacy occupied by the Union or to the four slave states which had remained loyal. Only two of these states, Maryland and Missouri, had outlawed slavery within their limits. Further action was needed, especially since doubts were expressed in many quarters about the constitutional rightness of Lincoln's proclamation and of the act passed by Congress in 1862 abolishing slavery in the territories. The 13th Constitutional Amendment was therefore proposed, prohibiting slavery in all areas within the jurisdiction of the United States. But here was a complication. The American Constitution provided that no amendment was valid until it had been ratified by three-quarters of the states. As the Union now consisted of 36 states, some at least of the 11 former Confederate states would have to ratify, if the 13th Amendment was to become effective. The position of the states which had seceded from the Union had to be defined. If they had, in fact, left the Union, should they return as the equals of their conquerors? If so, on what conditions? While the war was still in progress, Lincoln had dismissed the question of the legal status of the Confederate states as a pernicious abstraction. He'd been concerned only with restoring them to their proper practical relation with the Union. In December 1863, he'd set out a plan for their readmission. Pardon was offered, with a few exceptions, to all adherents of the Confederacy who would take an oath of loyalty to the Union. When such oaths had been taken by 10% of the electorate of any state, it remained only for state governments to be established which were prepared to abolish slavery. Then they would be readmitted. Lincoln's 10% plan was never carried out. Reconstructed governments were set up in 1864 in three of the Confederate states, which had fallen under the control of Union armies. But Congress refused to seat the senators and representatives whom they sent to Washington. Congress believed that Reconstruction was its business and not the president's. The radical Republicans who dominated Congress did not wish to smooth the path of the South's return to her allegiance. They wanted a harsh and vengeful policy, and they especially desired the immediate enfranchisement of the Negro. Radical vindictiveness sprang from various causes. The most creditable was a humanitarian concern for the welfare of the Negro. These feelings were shared only by a minority. More ignoble motives were present in the breasts of such radical leaders as Zachariah Chandler and Thaddeus Stevens. Loving the Negro less than they hated his master, these ill-principled men wanted to humiliate the proud Southern aristocracy whom they'd always disliked and at whose door they laid the sole blame for the Civil War. There was another and nearer point. The radicals saw that if the Negro was given the vote, they could break the power of the Southern planter and preserve the ascendancy over the federal government that Northern business interests had won since 1861. To allow the Southern states, in alliance with Northern Democrats, to recover their former voice in national affairs would, the radicals believed, be incongruous and absurd. It would also jeopardize the massive legislation on tariffs, banking, and public land which northern capitalists had secured for themselves during the war. To safeguard these laws, the radicals took up the cry of the Negro vote, meaning to use it to keep their own party in power. Even if Lincoln had lived to complete his second term, he would have met with heavy opposition from his own party. The magnanimous policy he'd outlined in April 1865, in the classic address delivered from the White House, was shattered by the bullet that killed him a few days later. The new president, Andrew Johnson of Tennessee, though sharing Lincoln's views on Reconstruction, was markedly lacking in political gifts. Nevertheless, from Lincoln's death until the end of the year, while Congress was in recess, Johnson was able to put into effect a Reconstruction plan closely resembling Lincoln's. Each Southern state, in conventions chosen by loyal electors, could qualify for readmission to the Union by repealing the ordinances of secession, repudiating the Confederate war debt, and abolishing slavery. The South, anxious, in the words of General Grant, to return to self-government within the Union as soon as possible, was quick to comply. Southerners then proceeded to elect state legislatures and officials, chose senators and representatives to go to Washington, and ratified the 13th Amendment, which went into force in December 1865. When Congress reconvened in that same month, it declined to seat the elected representatives of the South. Ignoring Johnson's work, Congress went on to put its own ideas into practice. Its first step was to set up a joint committee on Reconstruction, charged with the task of collecting information about Southern conditions. Later in the new year, this body, under radical control, reported that drastic measures were necessary to protect the emancipated Negro. Congress promptly took action. First came the Freedmen's Bureau Bill, which prolonged the life and greatly extended the powers of an agency set up earlier to assist Negroes to make the transition to freedom. This was followed by a civil rights bill, conferring citizenship on the Negroes and granting them equality of treatment before the law. Both these measures were vetoed by Johnson as unconstitutional infringements of the rights of the states. The civil rights bill was repassed over Johnson's veto and became law. The radicals, meanwhile, aimed at making doubly sure of their purposes by incorporating its provisions in the 14th Amendment. The quarrel between Johnson and the radicals was now open and bitter, and the congressional elections of 1866 witnessed a fierce struggle between them. The radicals were much the more astute in presenting their case to the electorate. They pointed to a serious race riot in New Orleans as proof of Southern maltreatment of the Negro, and to the recently enacted Black Codes as evidence of an intention to re-enslave him. Their leaders carried more conviction with the Northern electors than did Johnson, whose undignified outbursts during a speaking tour lost him much support. The result was a resounding victory for the radicals, who obtained a two-thirds majority in both houses of Congress. The way was now clear for them to carry out their own plan of Reconstruction, for they were strong enough to override the president's vetoes. A series of harsh and vengeful Reconstruction Acts was passed in 1867. The South was divided into five military districts, each under the command of a federal major general. The former Confederacy was to be subjected to army rule of the kind that Cromwell had once imposed on England. In order to be readmitted to the Union, the Southern states were now required to ratify the 14th Amendment and to frame state constitutions which provided for Negro suffrage, and this in spite of the fact that very few of the Northern states had as yet granted the Negro the vote. Not content with these successes, the radical leaders then tried to remove the president from office by impeachment. This would have suited them well, for as the law then stood, Johnson would have been replaced by the president of the Senate, who was himself a leading radical. According to the Constitution, the president could be thus dismissed on conviction for treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors. Yet Johnson's opposition to radical policies had never overstepped constitutional limits, and his enemies were put to some difficulty in framing charges against him. After vain endeavours to find any evidence of treason or corruptibility, the radicals put forward as a pretext for his impeachment Johnson's effort in August 1867 to rid himself of his Secretary of War, Edwin M. Stanton. This unscrupulous politician had long merited dismissal. He'd been in the habit of passing on cabinet secrets to the radical leaders while professing the utmost loyalty to the president. But when Johnson demanded his resignation, Stanton refused to comply. For some months he continued to conduct the business of the War Department, in which he finally barricaded himself. Stanton justified his conduct by reference to the Tenure of Office Act, a measure recently adopted over Johnson's veto as part of the radical effort to diminish the powers of the presidency. No cabinet officers, the Act had declared, were to be dismissed without the consent of the Senate. Failure to obtain consent was punishable as a high crime. Thus, in March 1868, the radical leaders were able to induce the House to adopt 11 articles impeaching Andrew Johnson at the bar of the Senate. The only concrete charge against him was his alleged violation of the Tenure of Office Act. Yet this measure was constitutionally doubtful, and its violation became a crime only because the radicals said so. In spite of the weakness of their case, they came within an ace of success. In the event, they failed by a single vote to obtain the two-thirds majority in the Senate which they needed to convict the president. 7 Republican senators, withstanding immense and prolonged pressure, refused to allow the impeachment process to be debased for party ends. They voted for acquittal. By the narrowest possible margin, a cardinal principle of the American Constitution, that of the separation of powers, was thus preserved. Had the impeachment succeeded, the whole course of American constitutional development would have been changed. Power would henceforth have become concentrated solely in the legislative branch of the government, and no president could have been sure of retaining office in the face of an adverse congressional majority. Nevertheless, the radicals were strong enough in Congress during the rest of Johnson's term to be able to ignore his wishes. A further Republican victory at the polls in 1868 brought General Ulysses S. Grant to the White House. The triumph of the radicals was now complete, for the ineptitude in high office of the victorious Union commander made him their tool. The political reconstruction of the South ground forward in strict accordance with the harsh legislation of 1867. Under the superintendence of federal military commanders, elections were held in which the Negro, for the first time, took part. Almost 1 million colored men were enrolled on the voting lists. At the same time, more than 100,000 Southern whites were disenfranchised because they'd been in rebellion. Negro voters were in a majority in 5 states. Yet the Negro was merely the dupe of his ill-principled white leaders. These consisted either of northern adventurers, known as carpetbaggers, whose main purposes in going south were to make fortunes for themselves and to muster the Negro vote for the Republican Party, or of southern scalawags, who were prepared, for the sake of office, to cooperate with the regime that most southern whites detested. Between 1868 and 1871, carpetbag and scalawag governments, supported by the Negro vote and by federal bayonets, were installed in all the southern states. When these states were deemed to have complied with the radical requirements, they were allowed to return to the Union. Fraud, extravagance, and a humiliating racial policy were imposed upon the South by radical rule. It could be maintained only by the drastic use of federal power. To bolster up the carpetbag governments, Congress initiated the 15th Amendment, which laid down that suffrage could not be denied to any citizen on grounds of race, color, or previous condition of servitude. A series of laws placed congressional elections under federal management and authorized the use of military force to suppress violence in the southern states. These measures were prompted by the vigorous efforts of white Southerners, both by legal methods and by threats to Negro voters from secret societies like the Ku Klux Klan, to overthrow the carpetbag governments and restore white supremacy. For a time, repression achieved its purpose, but gradually, state after state was recaptured by white voters. This success was partly due to the stubbornness of Southern resistance, and partly to a change in Northern sentiment. By the early 1870s, the ordinary Northerner had become fully alive to the political shortcomings of the Negro, and was scandalized by the corruption of the carpetbag governments. The Northern businessmen wanted an end to unsettled conditions, which were bad for trade. Above all, Northerners became weary of upholding corrupt minority governments by force. They began to withdraw their support from the radical program. By 1875, the radical Republicans had so far lost control that only South Carolina, Florida, and Louisiana were still in the hands of the carpetbaggers. In the following year, a way was opened for these states to recover control of their own affairs. After the presidential election of 1876, disputes arose in these three states over the validity of the election returns. The matter was extremely important, since the 19 electoral votes at stake were sufficient to decide the presidential contest. The Democratic candidate, Samuel J. Tilden, had obtained 184 electoral votes, or one short of a majority. The Republican, Rutherford B. Hayes, therefore needed all the disputed 19. When the controversy was referred to the House of Representatives, it was obvious that the Republican majority in that assembly would decide in favour of Hayes. So, as a sop to Democratic opinion generally, and to the South in particular, Hayes' supporters promised that federal troops would be withdrawn from the South as soon as Hayes took office. Mollified by this concession, the South abandoned its opposition to Hayes. In April 1877, a month after Hayes assumed the presidency, and 12 years after Lee's surrender at Appomattox, the last federal garrisons left the South. The remaining carpetbag governments promptly collapsed, white supremacy was everywhere restored, and the period of radical reconstruction was over. It had not been altogether an evil, for the carpetbag legislatures promoted a number of long-overdue reforms and accomplished some good work in building roads and bridges. But it was, on the whole, a shameful and discreditable episode. In the judgment of an American historian, the Negro and carpetbagger governments were among the worst that have ever been known in any English-speaking land. Reconstruction left in the South a legacy of bitterness and hatred greater by far than that produced by 4 years of war. Remembering the Republicans as the party of Negro rule, the white South for the next 50 years would vote almost to a man for the Democratic Party. The Negro himself gained little lasting benefit from Reconstruction. His advancement had been the plaything of self-seeking and cynical men, and was set back for an incalculable period. From the end of Reconstruction until the closing decade of the century, American politics lacked interest. Memories of the Civil War remained fresh, especially in the South, and the passions aroused by it could still be revived. Indeed, they often were, especially by the Republican Party, which made a practice at election times of waving the bloody shirt and denouncing their Democratic opponents as rebels and traitors. Yet the issues of the war itself were dead and unreplaced. No major questions divided the parties, no new policies were initiated, and scarcely a measure deserving the attention of the historian was placed on the statute book. Nor were the political personalities of the time any more exciting than the events in which they took part. A succession of worthy, mediocre men filled the presidency, the chief virtue of their administrations being the absence of the corruption which had disgraced the 2 terms of the unfortunate General Grant. With few exceptions, Congress, too, was filled with what one historian has called sad, solemn fellows. Yet if the politics of the period were insignificant, its economic developments were of the first importance. Throughout the generation that followed the Civil War, the pace of economic change quickened, and the main outlines of modern America emerged. Between 1860 and 1900, the population of the Union soared from 31 to 76 millions. This increase was due in part to the heavy influx of European immigrants, who, within 40 years, totaled 15 millions. Cities grew fast. Great mineral deposits were discovered and exploited, giving rise to vast new industries. No other generation in American history, it has been remarked, witnessed changes as swift or as revolutionary as those which transformed the rural republic of Lincoln and Lee into the urban industrial empire of McKinley and Roosevelt. Economic change transformed not only the regions which became great industrial centers, but the country as a whole. Even in the South, a revolution was afoot. In Southern agriculture, change was inevitable because of the disorganization wrought by the war and the ending of slavery. Nearly all the great planters, impoverished by the war and crushed by taxation during the Reconstruction, were compelled to split their plantations and sell, often at absurdly low prices. Thousands of small farmers were thus able to increase the size of their holdings. An even greater number of Southern whites, for the first time, became landowners. The old sprawling plantations disappeared and were replaced by an infinitely greater number of small farms, engaged, for the most part, in growing the same crops as before the war. Negroes, however, continued, as in the days of slavery, to provide the bulk of the labor for cotton cultivation. Because they lacked capital, few of the colored freedmen were able to buy farms or to pay rent. A novel form of tenantry known as sharecropping, therefore, came into being. Furnished by the farmer with land and equipment, the Negro, and later the landless white, gave their labor in return for one-third of the crop they produced. By these means, Southern agriculture slowly revived. But it was almost 20 years before the cotton crop of the former Confederate states reached the level of 1860. From then on, expansion was rapid, and by 1900, the pre-war figures had been more than doubled. This period saw also the beginnings of large-scale industry in the South. The Southern textile industry, very small before 1860, managed in time to recover and then to expand. Towards the end of the century, the South, with its raw material at hand and its supply of cheap labor, possessed almost 2 million spindles and was daring to challenge New England's position in the home market. At the same time, the tobacco industry flourished in North Carolina and Virginia, and the discovery of coal and iron deposits in Tennessee and Alabama led to the rise of a Southern iron industry. Yet the South remained predominantly agricultural, and the growth of Southern industry was insignificant compared with that of the North. The Civil War had given a great impetus to Northern output. The Federal armies had needed huge quantities of arms and equipment, clothing and footwear. Fortified by government contracts, Northern manufacturers embarked on large-scale production. Furthermore, in the absence of Southern representatives, Congress passed into law the protective measures demanded by Northern industrialists and financiers. But the assistance thus afforded did no more than speed the coming of the American Industrial Revolution. The United States were, and still are, extraordinarily rich in mineral wealth. They possessed about two-thirds of the known coal deposits of the world, immense quantities of high-grade iron ore, equally great resources in petroleum, and in the West, huge treasuries of gold, silver, and copper. Through their inventive ability and their aptitude for improving the inventions of others, Americans grasped the power to turn their raw materials into goods. To this, they added a magnificent transport system of railroads and canals, which fed the factories and distributed their products. Moreover, America could look to Europe for capital as well as labor. The bulk of her industrial capital came from British, Dutch, and German investors. Much of the brawn, and not a little of the brain, that went into her making were also supplied by the great immigration from Europe. Thus favored, American industry forged swiftly ahead. Each decade saw new levels of output in the iron and steel mills of the Pittsburgh area, the oil refineries of Ohio, Pennsylvania, and elsewhere, the flour mills of Minneapolis and St. Paul, the meatpacking plants of Chicago and Cincinnati, the clothing and boot and shoe factories of New England, and the breweries of Milwaukee and St. Louis, to mention only the biggest of American industrial enterprises. In each of these fields, great captains of industry arose, the most powerful of whom were Rockefeller in oil and Carnegie in steel. With untiring energy and skill, and with ruthless disregard for competitors, these men built up economic empires which gave them great wealth and a formidable power over the life of the community. Carnegie and Rockefeller, indeed, together with Morgan in finance and Vanderbilt and Harriman in railroads, became the representative figures of the age, in striking contrast to the colourless actors upon the political scene. Though the morality of their business methods has often been questioned, these men made industrial order out of chaos. They brought the benefits of large-scale production to the humblest home. By 1900, owing to their vigorous efforts, American industry was concentrated in a number of giant corporations, each practically a monopoly in its chosen field. This was a state of affairs presently to be challenged by federal authority. But meanwhile, the United States had ceased to depend on European manufacturers. They were even invading Europe with their own. Thus, America passed through a gilded age of which the millionaire seemed, at least to European eyes, the typical representative. Yet it was, at the same time, an age of unrest, racked by severe growing pains. There was much poverty in the big cities, especially among recent immigrants. There were sharp, sudden financial panics, causing loss and ruin, and there were many strikes, which sometimes broke into violence. Labour began to organise itself in trade unions, and to confront the industrialists with a stiff bargaining power. These developments were to lead to a period of protest and reform in the early 20th century. The gains conferred by large-scale industry were great and lasting, but the wrongs that had accompanied their making were only gradually righted. All this made for a lively, thrusting, controversial future. Chapter 4. America as a World Power. While the United States were growing into the world's leading industrial power, their people were busily completing the settlement of the continent. At the beginning of the Civil War, after 2.5 centuries of westward advance from the Atlantic coast, the frontier of settlement had reached roughly the line of the 97th meridian, which runs through Nebraska, Kansas, Oklahoma, and Texas. Between this frontier and the towns and cities of the Pacific seaboard lay 1,000 miles of wilderness. Here were the Great Plains, about 1,000,000 square miles in extent, where roamed many Indian tribes, and little else except the immense herds of buffalo on which they lived. The sparse rainfall of the Great Plains and lack of timber had made them seem unsuitable for farming and unlikely ever to be peopled. Yet in less than a generation, large parts of this huge area were settled by white men, and the natural frontier disappeared. The population west of the Mississippi rose in 30 years from about 5 million in 1860 to almost 18 million, while the number of states in the Union increased from 33 to 44. By 1890, only 4 more states remained to be carved out of the West. These were Utah, Oklahoma, New Mexico, and Arizona, all admitted to the Union by 1912, when the political shape of the country became complete. White settlement of the Great Plains was first prompted by the discovery of precious metals. In 1859, gold was found at Pike's Peak, on the eastern slopes of the Rockies, and miners began to flock into Colorado. As fresh deposits of gold, silver, and copper came to light, there was a rush to Nevada, Arizona, Idaho, and Montana, and finally to the Black Hills of South Dakota. These sudden migrations in search of wealth did not always create lasting settlements, for many of the booms were short-lived. When precious ores ran low, the whole population of the mining camps moved on elsewhere, leaving ghost towns to mark the site of their diggings. Yet by speeding the political organization of the West and encouraging the building of railroads, the discovery of gold and silver did much to open up the Great Plains. It was the railway, indeed, more than any other factor, which threw wide the plains to settlers. This was the great age of American railroad construction. At the close of the Civil War, the United States had possessed about 35,000 miles of tracks, but in less than 10 years, That figure had been doubled, and by 1890, doubled again. The most prodigious feat was the building of a number of transcontinental railways. The first across the continent was completed in May 1869, when a link was made in Utah between the lines of the Union Pacific, stretching westward from Iowa, and the Central Pacific, reaching out eastward from California. This project was financed by a grant from Congress to the two companies of millions of acres of public land, a method which was also used elsewhere. Towards the end of the century, three more transcontinental routes had been added, and other great lines had opened up the country. Many of the railroad companies took a direct part in peopling the West, for they realized that their lines could hardly pay until the country on either side of the tracks was settled. An extensive campaign to popularize the West was undertaken both in the eastern states and in Europe. Because transport was cheap and land could be acquired on credit, thousands of settlers were induced to seek new homes in the Great Plains. Emigrants to the West could also buy land very cheaply from the state governments, each of which had received from the federal authorities large areas of the public domain. They could even obtain it free by virtue of the Homestead Act, which granted a quarter section, 160 acres, of public land to all white adult males who undertook to settle there. Although a loophole in the Act allowed land speculators to profit by it, this measure enabled large numbers of settlers, estimated in 1890 at more than a million, to obtain free farms for themselves, mostly to the west of the Mississippi. The settlement of the West could only take place if the Indian barrier were removed. Already by the time of the Civil War, the Indian had been obliged to retreat across half the continent in the face of white advance. Now, as the red man was harried out of his last refuge, a further tragic chapter was added to his story. The threat to their hunting grounds, and indeed to their whole existence, delivered by the onrush of civilization, impelled the nomadic tribes of the Great Plains to resist the invaders with determination and savagery. From the Sioux and the Crows of the north to the Comanche and Apache of the south, these warlike tribesmen were magnificent horsemen and intrepid fighters. Their bows and arrows were much more effective than the muzzle-loading rifles with which the federal troops were at first equipped. Yet their final defeat was inevitable. The introduction of the Winchester repeating rifle and the Colt revolver gave armed supremacy to the whites, who were already superior in organization, numbers, and strategy. But the fatal blow was the wholesale slaughter of the buffalo, chiefly by professional hunters employed by eastern leather manufacturers. By the early 1870s, between 2 and 3 million buffalo were being killed annually for their hides, and 10 years later, a museum expedition seeking specimens could find only 200 in the whole of the West. On the buffalo, the Indian of the plains had relied not only for food, but for a great variety of other things, from clothing to fuel. When the buffalo was virtually exterminated, nomadic life became impossible. The Indians had to comply with the government's plans and be herded into reservations. Means had still to be found in the semi-arid West for making agriculture pay. The miner was at first succeeded not by the farmer, but by the rancher, who for 20 years after the Civil War used the Great Plains as pasture for his cattle on the long drive from Texas to the Middle West. Although the journey involved passing through territory inhabited by hostile Indians, who frequently stampeded the cattle, vast herds were led each year from the ranches of the Southwest to the cattle centers of Kansas and Nebraska. Then, after being fattened for market, the cattle were shipped to the stockyards and canneries of Kansas City or Chicago. But the farmer still hung back from the Great Plains. In this extensive grassland, there were very few trees, and no lumber for building houses, barns, and fences. More serious still, the annual rainfall between the 98th meridian and the Rockies was usually below the 20-inch minimum needed for agriculture. Science now stepped in. A technique known as dry farming was developed. Deep ploughing loosened the soil sufficiently to allow water to move upwards, and frequent harrowing prevented evaporation. New strains of wheat were introduced from Russia, which were resistant to drought and to the disease of wheat rust, then common on the plains. But it was large-scale industry that really made farming possible. A wide range of mechanical farm implements, reapers, harvesters, threshers, and improved types of plough, enabled the Western farmer to cultivate large enough tracts of land to offset the low yield per acre. Moreover, the invention of barbed wire, though it ended the great cattle drives, solved the problem of fencing. During the last quarter of the century, large numbers of emigrant farmers were flowing into the Great Plains. By 1890, the frontier, which officially meant a region inhabited by more than 2 but less than 6 persons per square mile, had disappeared. The formerly unsettled area, the superintendent of the census explained, had now been so broken into by isolated bodies of settlement that there could be hardly said to be a frontier line. The colonization, begun at Jamestown, Virginia, almost 3 centuries before, was now complete. Hitherto, the frontier had been America's safety valve. Through it had passed ardent ambitions and bold, restless spirits. Now the safety valve was shut, and the problems and pressures of dynamic growth within the United States were greatly intensified. After slumbering since the end of Reconstruction, American politics suddenly awoke. The alarm clock was populism. Sprung from deep-rooted discontent among farmers, this new movement made rapid headway. A climax was reached in 1896, when the populists, merged by then with the Democratic Party, made a supreme effort at the polls. The presidential campaign of that year was one of the fiercest and most spectacular in American history. It was concentrated on a single issue, namely, whether there should be both a gold and silver currency, or monometallism versus bimetallism. Known as the Battle of the Standards, this contest was a passionate attempt by the farming interests to wrest control of the federal government from the financiers and industrialists, who'd enjoyed its favor since the Civil War. Agriculture, like all other branches of American life, had grown immensely since the Civil War. Within 40 years, the number of farms and the acreage under cultivation about trebled. Production of wheat, corn, cotton, and other commodities rose in similar proportion. But life had also become more difficult for the farmer. As production rose, farm prices steadily fell. At the same time, farm costs were rising, and large numbers of farmers faced hardship. Many had to become tenants, and mortgages multiplied. For this decline, there were several reasons. In some areas, especially in the Old South and the Middle West, the soil was exhausted by wasteful methods of cultivation. Elsewhere, as on the Great Plains, the farmer faced peculiar natural hazards. Yet these were difficulties which he had always had to endure, and the real explanation of his plight lay in another quarter. In spite of the rise in population, the growth of the cities, and the enormous demand for food, he always produced too much. Canada, South America, and Australia, all of which